Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson. On Utah's home for elevated conversation. Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
As we work our way through what will be an intense election cycle here in 2024, one of the things that we're trying to get to is how do we make sure we can restore trust? We've lost a lot of trust in elected officials. We've lost trust in the institutions of government. We've lost trust in many aspects of the media, particularly nationally. And as a result, we've also lost trust in each other. Is there a different way to get to a better solution and a better conversation? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's time to think again about what we think we know and ask some better questions. And one of the great question askers in our community is the executive editor of the Deseret News, Doug Wilkes. And Doug, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Boyd. It's great to be with you. You're not only the man of the hour, you're the man of every hour. So thank you.
We had a great opportunity, a fascinating event yesterday down at Utah Valley University at the Gary R. Herbert Institute for Public Policy, talking about election integrity and trust in the election process, including this aspect of media. And it was just a great conversation throughout the day. So let's start kind of high level. You watched some of the panels, and then you and I were participants in a panel with Lauren Gustas from the Tribune as well. But give us kind of a high level reaction.
Well, this is really an effort by some Republicans who want conservatives to kind of own the territory of trusting the elections, including Deidre Henderson, our own lieutenant governor here in Utah. And they really want to put forth this idea, like, look, these elections are secure, they're safe, they're dispersed. So the idea that someone could control the elections or there'd be collusion when it's really county by county, state by state, is really a false premise, and they want to get that word out. So Johns Hopkins University, R Street, which is a conservative think tank, and then also in conjunction with the Gary R. Herbert Public Policy Institute in Sutherland, put this event on, brought in people from Idaho and elsewhere to really try and talk about election integrity.
Yeah, and it was such a great conversation. I was amazed at how many people were there that were leaning into this conversation from really across the spectrum in terms of both politics and also just in terms of professions. I thought that was really fascinating to see that all go. And so as we kind of start at the high level of it, Doug, you've had a unique perch in the media for a long time throughout your career. And as you look at that in terms of the media's role in all of this, just kind of walk us through some of the dynamics, some of the challenges, and how do we ensure that we're adding to that trust factor?
Well, I think if you look at Utah as kind of a case study, 10 years ago, Utah began vote by mail. And the whole purpose of it was to increase participation. There was great concern that people weren't turning out to vote. So they started doing vote by mail. The participation rate increased, and it was very strong. Then, through COVID, other states weren't prepared to do vote by mail. People were concerned. And by then, in 2020, the dialogue had changed. So, for example, trust in media. 2016, 70% of the population had some trust in media. Mm. By 2021, you know, 5 years later, it'd be down to 35%. College campuses are seeing the same thing now, drops of like 50% in trust. So it's both the institutions that we're kind of questioning and some of the premises and beliefs we had before, not everyone shares.
Yeah. And so that leads to, I think, what is a real challenge. And Pew Research did some interesting studies on this in terms of where we are as it relates to misinformation and disinformation. Obviously, national media has a role in that. Local media has a role in that. And social media plays a huge role in all of that. How do you thread that needle?
Well, we do know there are bad actors, other countries that try and very deliberately put misinformation out there. Yeah. There's plenty of studies showing that, both with sort of cyber attacks, but also then trying to get into the hands of American voters, information to hurt the American cause, to hurt democracy, to hurt the republic. Separate from that, we've lost so many journalists. We have talking heads that aren't journalists, but people think they're journalists. Media literacy has gone down, so it's harder for people to discern truth. So in our newsroom, we talk about, well, is it true? That's really the first question we said. And then we try to peel back what we can do to contribute to the conversation.
Yeah, and I think this is an important part. I think it's an important part, especially in the local media, that there are reasons to have levels of trust. And you walked through some of the things in terms of simple things, like even making sure you've got a second source. But a second source alone doesn't necessarily mean it's a good second source. It may actually be an echo chamber. Kind of describe that.
Right. So we'll get tips all the time, or we'll look at, someone will say something about an election machine, for example, and you go out and you need two sources to confirm that something is true or not true. And even that might not be enough, right? You really need to dig in. But sometimes there is an echo chamber, meaning you might talk to two or three people, but they're coming to you with all the same information from the same place. Yeah. So even though you might be talking to different people, it might still only be one source. So you have to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. I want to get into this area that I thought was one of the really big aha moments yesterday. And you described it in terms of both within a newsroom and obviously in our communities and in society, that when we get to this area of contempt, it becomes harder and harder to actually get to the truth.
Right. So media, some of the criticism of media, a lot of the criticism is deserved, right? Because sometimes, national media is different than local media, but they express contempt for a candidate and even contempt then for those who support the candidate. So, for example, if half the country supports Donald Trump and half the country supports Joe Biden, can you really afford to have contempt for half the country? Mm. So what became clear to me, particularly during the Iowa caucus, the Republican voters had a choice. They had Nikki Haley. They had many different candidates they could choose from, and they overwhelmingly chose Donald Trump. So given a choice, they chose Donald Trump. So we began saying, look, we're not going to look at the candidate anymore. We want to look at those making the votes, those who are really thinking, what are the pain points they're trying to solve? And we hear things like, well, Trump's a fighter for me, or, the Democrats have a message, but all I want is to be left alone. I've heard that a lot.
Yeah.
So people are trying to figure out how to best live their lives. And then you can go into the issues of whether food prices are too big or whether you have a job or don't have a job, upward mobility, which you've talked a lot about.
Yeah.
So we're really focused on the electorate.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important thing for all of us to think through. That whole area of contempt, that someone isn't just wrong, they're wrong and evil, or they're wrong and ignorant, or wrong and stupid, or whatever it may be, because that prevents us from listening. It prevents us from asking better questions. I wonder why she thinks that's a great idea. I wonder why he thinks that's good policy. And so I think that whole idea of let's get past contempt for individuals or political parties or institutions, or even for people who look and think different than we do, then we can have a better conversation.
Well, even at the Republican convention in Utah, where there was some expressing contempt, if you will, for Governor Cox's Disagree Better. Well, how can you have contempt for Disagree Better, right? We talked to a lot of the candidates coming to our editorial board, and some are very desirous and wanting to work across the aisle. Others are saying, no, we need a line in the sand. It's our way or the highway. Our way is the right way. Voters can decide who to send to Washington and what to do. But it's an interesting perspective, and I think it's a little different than when we've been in past decades.
Yeah, well, that'll be fascinating to watch. We look forward to having you back for the journey and for some good analysis and perspective in terms of how we have these conversations. And I think Doug nailed it yesterday down at Utah Valley University when he got to this whole issue of contempt. If we let contempt cloud our vision, we'll never be able to see the future we actually want to create together. Doug Wilkes, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Boyd. Good to be here.
So again, it's time to think again about what we think we know. And if you find yourself in that feeling of contempt, if you find yourself saying that person is awful or horrible or terrible, that's a big red flag, because you can't be curious, you can't ask good questions, and you can't even hear a response that might change your perspective and cause you to think again. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And of course, as the clock continues to tick forward towards The first Tuesday in November, elections are heating up. A primary election coming up here, June the 25th. And one of the races that we're keeping our eye on, of course, is the 3rd Congressional District. And we're really thrilled to have joining us on the program today one of those candidates is who is on the primary ballot, Stuart Pei. And Stuart, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon, Boyd. It's great to be on with you.
Wonderful. As we get started today, I wanted to first just start with just a little bit of your backstory. Help us understand why this race, why now?
Sure. So, you know, I grew up in the 3rd Congressional District, went to high school there. I've lived my whole life there. And I look at where our country is today, and it is not moving in the direction that I think most of the people in the 3rd Congressional District want it moving in. I think they want conservative values and conservative ideas pushed forward. And so I got in the race because through 12 years in the military, including a year in Iraq, 20 years practicing law here in Salt Lake City, and also as the Utah County Republican Party chair, I've developed the breadth and depth of skills that I believe will allow me to go to Congress and deal with some difficult situations and difficult people to get our country back on track. And that's why I got in this race, and that's what I'm running to do.
Yeah, as you've been out and about, and you've been in and around the political circles for a few years now, and so people have gotten to know you in that, what have you gotten to know about the voters in the 3rd District over the course of the campaign thus far?
So I think they're focused on the problems we see in Washington. They're focused on federal spending that's out of control. They're focused on immigration that is tearing apart, you know, that is causing many issues throughout our country. And they're focused on national security issues, things like Ukraine, Israel, and, you know, the other threats we have to the United States of America.
Yeah, so important. And we're going to go to a little bit of a breaking news sound. That's what we play when there is breaking news. And Stuart, I understand you do have a little bit of breaking news as it relates to a key endorsement in this 3rd congressional race.
That's right, Boyd. Thank you. I'm excited to share with you that I have earned Senator Romney's endorsement in the Republican 3rd Congressional District primary. I'm very pleased and proud to have his endorsement at this time. And I look forward to continuing the great representation the 3rd District has had for many years under John Curtis. Like I said a minute ago, I'm a conservative that wants to govern, who wants to get this country back on track, and I will be a serious, substantive, responsible legislator. And that's why I'm running, as you asked a minute ago, and I believe that we've seen a lot of effective people in Congress, and Utah needs those types of people, and that's the type of person that I'm going to Congress to be.
Yeah, and that is an important piece of news there coming out of Washington today that Utah Junior Senator Mitt Romney has endorsed Stuart Pei in the 3rd congressional race. You can actually see the full statement from Senator Romney. You can go to KSL.com. That will be posted there. And Stuart, as you continue to look at how you move forward in the race, and as you've been taking in a lot of the conversations, has anything surprised you as an official candidate for a federal position? What surprised you in this process?
I was the county party chair a few years ago. I've been involved with a lot of different things. I don't think there's been a lot of surprises. I think what has, you know, caught my eye is the serious view of I think what has surprised me is how frustrated Utahns are with the Republican Party not governing. You know, we've got a majority in Congress right now, and we're not getting anything done. I think there was a lot of frustration over the omnibus bill. I think there's been a lot of frustration over the back and forth with the speaker. I think Republicans in Utah are can-do people, and they want to see a can-do Congress, especially when the Republicans are in charge.
Yeah, and so give us a sense of the focus. We always say that the biggest challenge in Washington is focus. Everything is chasing and racing, and sometimes that's done by design by leaders of both parties to keep people distracted from work that they might want to get done. Focus always precedes success, especially when it comes to Congress. So what will be the focus going in? First day on the job, on the floor of the House of Representatives, what does that look like? What's the first message?
Sure. So I've already actually started that process. A couple weeks ago, I went back and met with a couple of congressional members who are veterans. And I asked them a question very similar to the one you just asked me, Boyd. And, you know, I think the first thing is building coalitions and building relationships so we can get things done. I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, the chasing and, you know, trying to keep people's eye off the ball. I believe if you build teams and you build coalitions as a group, you can keep your eye on the ball and you can work on issues that really matter. You know, those include spending, immigration, and national defense, which are, you know, huge issues for our country right now and things we need to deal with immediately.
Yeah, no question. And as you look at your experience as a Utah Army National Guard, someone who spent time in a war zone in Iraq, give us a sense in terms of the lessons there and what you'll take to Washington as a result of that.
Sure. I think there's a couple things. I think, you know, a generation ago, 76% of the members of Congress had served in the military. Today, it's only 18. And, you know, one of the things I learned when I was in the military is that through that military experience, you get a joint set of values and a joint set of experiences that you can use to, you know, move forward. And in Congress, you can use that to build relationships with those people. You know, you start from a similar position on military issues. Secondly, you know, the sacrifices that this country requires. You know, we've had far too many men and women spend far too much time in foreign countries. And I think it's because maybe our leaders didn't realize the sacrifice that that takes up and what it means. On the other hand, we also realize that there is a time to fight. There is a time to protect our freedoms. And we understand what needs to be done to prepare for those. And I think sometimes readiness and training and things like that aren't a good enough focus for Congress.
Yeah. And then final question for you. This is a question I've asked everyone from people running for president of the United States down to the local county commission. I think it's the most important question. And as you've experienced, Stuart, you know that campaigns are rough and tumble and hard and exhausting and exasperating. And what is it? Of course, everyone's trying to win. Everyone expects to win. What would make all of this worth it, even if in the end you didn't win?
Boy, like I say, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution a long time ago. And I have always taught my kids that, you know, being an American has duties and responsibilities. And, you know, that for me, it flows from my time in the military on down. And they've already watched this process. They've already learned a lot. They've learned, like you say, how hard it is, how tough it is. And they've learned that we have to sacrifice for our country. They've learned that the principles and the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution aren't free. They aren't just there for anyone's taking. They have to be fought for. They have to be cultivated, and they've realized what it takes to do that, and they've seen me do it now, and I hope that it instills in them a similar sense of duty to do that throughout their lives.
Great perspective. Stuart Pei, running in the 3rd Congressional District. Stuart, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll have you back on as we march towards June the 25th and that primary for the 3rd Congressional District. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Boyd. Have a great day.
All right. Again, that's Stuart Pei. Part of that 3rd congressional field, a big field there for the June 25th primary. And as he said, news breaking today that Senator Mitt Romney has endorsed Stuart Pei in that 3rd congressional race. And you can find that statement from Senator Romney at KSL.com. And we're going to go ahead and step aside for some bottom of the hour news. More inside sources coming up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We've covered the ongoing debate regarding social media use among our young people in particular, and there's still much to debate because we have a lot more to learn. I think as the technology continues to develop, things continue to change. I think one of the important things is that parents don't have to feel powerless in their kids' social landscape. Social media and smartphones are not a requirement for children. I think that's an important message. They're not a prerequisite for fitting in or being part of the
with the three cool things.
Kids. We don't have to especially wait for Congress to fix this because that is an eternal wait in many instances. So we want to get to some practical tacticals in terms of what it looks like and what we should be looking for and what who we should be looking to when it comes to all of this. Stephen Kent is the media director of the Consumer Choice Center. He's also the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. We're just waiting for Stephen to get back on the line. Had a little technical glitch there. And one of the things that he lays out in his piece at Reason.com is that so many parents are just feeling so hopeless and so helpless when it comes to their kids and social media. And they don't have to feel that way. They feel like they don't have any options, that they just have to give up and give in because they don't want to be that parent. Nobody wants to be that parent. And again, it's a great piece at Reason. You can check it out at reason.com. And I think we got Stephen on the line now. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So let's dive right into this. We talk about how many parents just feel like they've got no options in terms of what they can do because of the pressure that they're getting, a lot of the pressure from their own kids and from other kids. They don't want to be the bad parent. But then also we have Congress kind of swirling around the outside, but not really doing anything. What should we be thinking about? How should we be looking at this?
Well, my perspective as someone who works at the Consumer Choice Center, where we believe very much in giving, you know, consumers of technology products and anything on the market the ability to choose for themselves rather than have the government do it for them. But also as a parent of a 13-year-old daughter who I think is very much in the crosshairs of a lot of not just like tech companies, but also bad cultural movements who, you know, she shouldn't be engaging with. I don't really want her to be on social media, and we've raised her as such. But my staunch belief is that parents do still have the power, the authority, and the ability to choose how things are going to be handled in their individual households. And we shouldn't look to Congress just yet to legislate on this issue with things like the Kids Off Social Media Act from Ted Cruz and the Kids Online Safety Act from Senator Mark Blumenthal.
Yeah. And so as you look at some of these, one, I love the title of your piece in Reason, Don't Co-Parent with Congress. That's really bad strategy because parents do have that. And I think part of what you do at the Consumer Choice Center is get to some of those choices. So let's go through some of those. You point out several of these in your piece at Reason, but give us some of the things that parents should say, okay, I can immediately go down this path, or I can use this technology or this approach that might get a better result.
Absolutely. So I was really excited when I found out that there are already a ton of products on the market that are useful for parents and families like ours, where we are not going all in on social media and smartphones in our household until our daughter is, you know, at least nearing the end of high school. One such product is the Bark Phone. The Bark Phone is a nerfed Android device in the sense that it is an Android phone so that your kid can enjoy the social credit of having, you know, what looks like a smartphone. But it is completely permission-based from front to back, and everything that happens on it has to be approved by the parent managing it on their own device. If the kid wants Google Maps, it has to be requested. If the kid wants TikTok, it has to be requested. And you also are getting AI-generated updates on things that are being said on the phone, you know, text, communication, photos that are shared on the phone that AI detects as being potentially harmful. Now, it can be a little bit over the top in some of its monitoring, but those are things that you can turn off if you think it's a little bit too much.
Yeah, and I think that's important, too, because then it's the parent making the choice, not a social media app and not a government regulation of one form or another. It's actually parents parenting, which I know may seem like a radical concept today.
Yeah, well, people are scared. You know, technology is moving really, really fast. And I think a lot of parents are just completely gobsmacked by the time and the technical understanding that it takes to manage some of these devices. We struggled to set up the Bark Phone for a couple of days. And we're millennials. You know, my wife and I are about 34. And we struggled, but we figured it out. It wasn't that hard. Technical service can help you through it. And you set up the device. And then there are also competitors on the market to the Bark Phone. There's Trumi, there's Pinwheel, there's Gab Phone. And those phones don't even allow for parents to get their kids onto social media. So those phones are designed to prohibit social apps of all kinds, and even if the parents change their mind, they don't accommodate it. You know, so there are ways that your kid can move around town and you can keep track of where they are. You can make sure they're not engaging with strangers or sharing dangerous materials and text messages. But then you can also just, you know, make sure that they've got the kind of device they need to move through the modern world and learn their way.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing, is to help them figure out how to navigate that. While having some good guardrails there that, again, are done by choice, not by chance, One of the things that you mentioned in your piece that I don't think a lot of parents even think of, they're worried about a lot of the sites and the algorithms and that, but a lot of them aren't even thinking about what kids are picking up just off of Spotify or music apps.
it's pretty alarming. I mean, I note in my article over at Reason that the monitoring on the Bark phone for my daughter is kind of funny. It sends me notifications when my daughter's listening to songs by Journey and the Killers, Mr. Brightside, and the AI in the phone detects, you know, sexual or violent lyrics or mentions of guns. And that's a little goofy, but if my daughter were being served up by Spotify's recommended music, you know, songs by Cardi B that are intensely sexual in nature, I would want to know that. Yeah. I would absolutely want to know that. And I say that as a consumer who uses Spotify every single day. I get recommended some songs that I have no interest in listening to. and that's going to happen to your kid as well. That's what happens on YouTube. You know, I, for one, like, I'm always surprised by my YouTube algorithm. It suggests some videos to me that are shocking. And I looked at my daughter's YouTube and checked out some of the things that she was being recommended. And I will tell you, the recommended videos page was 10 perfectly appropriate videos and then one that I just made my eyes pop with the sexual nature of it. And I was like, why would this even be on YouTube? And why is this being recommended to a child?
This is such an important conversation. And I love the fact that you're saying, hey, parents, you got to be in the game. This is what parenting looks like. This is what parenting sounds like. This is what parenting acts like. The best way to do it is to actually do it and not look to Washington, not look to the social media platforms to do the job, because it just won't get done.
Yep. Once you give that power away, remember, everybody, you will never get it back. If you cede ground to Congress to manage any part of your life, it's a power that you will never get back. And we as parents, we need to keep up with the tech as best we can. We need to take the time to read and learn about different products that are on the market. And if you're asking me as a private individual and as a parent, you don't give your kid smartphone devices or social media until they're mid-teens. I think that that is backed up by science. I think that is backed up by research on the effects that it has on children, but to each their own. At the end of the day, though, you don't have to give them the same device you have. There are ones out there that are modified for children's use, and I don't think people really know about them.
Yeah, great perspective. Stephen Kent's the media director of the Consumer Choice Center. He's also the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. Stephen, great perspective, great piece. Everyone check that out at Reason.com today. And Stephen, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Again, that's Stephen Kent from the Consumer Choice Center. And we'll go ahead and step aside for a quick commercial break. But don't go anywhere. We're going to stay on the theme and some of the impact of how this is impacting our generations and our young people. Lois Collins is going to join us talking about the ability to connect, even eye connection, coming up next. Stick around.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Of course, the feeling of belonging is one of the most important things for human well-being. We know that not just through the course of the pandemic, but throughout all history, isolation, lack of connection, that fear of being able to reach out can inhibit all kinds of personal development, rob us from all kinds of rich experiences, and most important, the connections that make life really worth it. Fascinating piece by our good friend Lois Collins, who does special projects, family issues for the Deseret News, and has a great piece about connection and Gen Z in particular. And Lois, always great to have you in studio. Give us a sense in terms of where are we, especially with Gen Z, in terms of this ability to really connect.
So it's an international survey, and I focused primarily on the United States in my reporting. So anybody who wants to look further can look at the actual survey. It's called the Relate Project, and it's all about relating. It's done by a Christian group called Young Life, and they surveyed all these kids about family relationships, about how they feel about themselves. And I think two things really jumped out at me in this. The first is that kids really love their families. And when I say kids, they talk specifically to those 13 to 24. They really love their families. They count on their families. But about 40% of them don't necessarily feel like they deserve to be loved. Mm. And I think that there's something there, especially for adults.
Yeah.
To reach out to kids and help them feel like you deserve to be loved. We love you. God loves you. You're worth it.
Yeah.
That was a very striking finding.
Yeah. I want you to, before we go to the next piece of that, I know there's more components to that, but I want to unpack that a little bit more, because that feeling of not being deserving, I think there's a lot underneath the hood when it comes to that one.
I think, and they didn't go into huge detail. They had kind of a set series of questions, yeah. But other reporting I've done, part of it ties into the whole anxiety and depression thing that we're seeing. And we don't know what part of that is actually like environmental, what's contributing to it. We don't know.
Yeah.
They're still trying to figure that out. But these kids feel really, really hopeful. They're moving forward, but they're really unsure of their place in the world. And I think COVID may have played a part in that.
Yeah.
If you go back 4 years, the oldest of these kids were 20. Mm-hmm. The youngest ones were little guys in like pre-middle school, 9 years old. I think that there was a feeling of disconnection there. Things went on Zoom, all sorts of things happened in COVID.
Yeah.
And so maybe they just feel a little more disconnected than the generations before and after them. I think time will tell, and time will tell if they kind of recuperate from that.
Yeah.
But that's me speculating based on other reporting.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I do think that's so interesting. And I think that we often talk about how do we help kids have that sense of peace so that they can adapt and adjust and learn and move forward. But I think to your point, Lois, I think it's also this sense of place.
It is a sense of place.
They feel very disconnected.
Yep. There's a sense of place, and there's a sense of time. The world is a little bit crazy right now. People are maybe sometimes less civil than they ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it seems like there's more road rage. There's a lot more going on right now, and I'm right and you're wrong and that kind of thing. And I think that's hard. But one of the things that was really important in this that goes to your point is that adults are so important, but it's important to have adults who are not just family members.
Right.
So the survey found that kids turn first to their moms. They also, at least half of them, turn to their dads as well. So dads are not left out, but about 2/3 to 3/4 of them say mom is their go-to if they need advice, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Moms tend to be more apt to be home with them, it's just different. It's a different dynamic without taking anything away from dads. But equally important is how many of these kids feel like they have another adult who is not a family member. So we're not talking about Uncle Joe or Aunt Susie. We're talking about coaches, teachers, mentors, different people who make them feel like they believe in them, they have their back, and they will show up for them. And the numbers are really pretty high when you're about 13 to 15 years old.
Yeah.
And then the numbers sink a little bit when you're 16 and 18. And that's the other thing that really stood out in this study, is that about 16 to 18 years old, kids can't figure out where they are in the world. They're getting ready to make some tricky transitions.
Yeah.
They are trying to kind of emotionally and physically separate themselves a little bit from their parents. Friends take on like this huge dynamic, and you can only pray that your kids have good friends who are good people. And that's an age of kind of disconnect. And you start seeing some of this disconnect and the sense of not being sure that you're lovable in those kind of teenage, potentially rebellious years.
Yeah, I think connecting those dots, I think, is so vital. And I want to go back just to that another adult, not family member. Anyone who ever thinks for a nanosecond that signing up to be the coach of the Little League softball team or lacrosse team or being the driver to the dance studio or volunteering at the school, being part of the PTA, if you think for a second that doesn't make a difference, the data doesn't lie. And when kids have that connection, teacher, coach, parent, instructor, that is a huge difference maker, especially when they get to that 16 to 18 range where suddenly they're pulling more away from parent. And I think that disconnect, if they don't have another adult in the room, so to speak, that they can trust and turn to, that's where a lot of that displacement, I think, begins.
Even the guy in the driveway who's working on, you know, fixing a car, who sees a kid who looks kind of interested going by, you can wave him over and say, hey, do you know what this is? Do you know? I mean, you just look for ways to connect with kids so that they feel, I think, primarily seen. If you reach out to them, I had a whole group of kids. I grow tomatoes, and I don't eat tomatoes. I just grow tomatoes, baby tomatoes.
We're going to have a whole separate show about that.
I had a whole group of kids, though, that would, as they go by, it was kind of a joke in the neighborhood that they go by, and I'd toss a cherry tomato into their mouths. And it was just kind of this thing we did. But they knew that I saw them and that they mattered to me in this stupid, small way. Mm. So not all of us are going to be coaches or teachers, but you could all find a stupid, small way to show up for kids.
Yeah. And in many cases, just asking them a question about what they're doing. If you know they're in the school play, if you know they're going to a different school, you know they're starting some new activity, a question, a specific question from an adult, I think is so powerful. Often it's more important and more significant than just a statement of praise of, hey, good job, way to go, giving them a chance to share.
As long as you listen to the answer, and you don't use it as an excuse to interject constant advice.
Yes.
So seriously, it's so simple. I do this all the time where I'm like, what do you think about this? Because here's what I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's not helpful.
That's right. The advice column is has to be the separate part of the program, to be sure. Anything else stand out for you just in our last minute from the survey?
Just how much hope there is. I mean, I love the fact that kids love their family so much. I love the fact. The other thing that stood out to me was that more than half of kids would much prefer to be with their friends face-to-face than like texting or screen time or stuff. Although I will say observationally that once they're face-to-face, they may always, you know, they may all be on screens. But at least they're talking to each other and they're engaging face to face. And that's something else that as adults we can do is engage face to face with young people.
Yeah. Nothing more important. Lois Collins always gets us down to the essence of the essence of the issues. And this is a great piece. You need to check this out at Deseret.com. Again, connection matters to Gen Z, but they're not sure they deserve love. That's something that is one of those big red flags we all should be concerned about. We all should be thinking about. And most important, it's something we all can do something about to help those young people feel like they do have a place, that they do belong, that they are loved and that they are lovable by the interest we take in them and the opportunities we provide them to share what their world looks like makes all the difference in the world. Lois Collins, as always, thanks for joining us today.
You bet.
All right, that's going to wrap it up here for hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. If you missed anything thus far in the show, you're going to want to go back. Go to kslpodcast.com. You can hear all the segments of the show. We post those later on in the afternoon today, so you can go back to all of our extraordinary guests and re-listen. It's what I do because I learn so much from each of our guests on this show. You can go do the same. Well, we're going to step aside for some top-of-the-hour news. Big hour number two coming up next, so stick around. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios,
this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
We're always looking for the additional angles and under-the-surface conversations on whatever the big topics of the day are. It's getting underneath the headlines, and there's been a lot of headlines of late in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, the conflict between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And that whole conflict is way more complicated than it's often displayed. It often gets conflated, especially in the national media, the mainstream media. The protests that have been happening on campus likewise have been conflated into a whole host of things. And so often we don't really get the perspective in terms of what's really going on. How's this really being perceived? We focused a lot on what Americans are thinking about things, but we want to shift gears a little bit today. And we're going to see what does it look like inside of Israel today. On the New York Times podcast, the Ezra Klein Show, journalist and just a great thinker, Ezra Klein, interviewed an Israeli journalist to dig a little deeper, again, past the headlines and do a little reverse engineer. What does what's happening here in the U.S. look like from inside of Israel? Fascinating stuff. So Ezra Klein spoke to Ari Shavit. And again, Ari's a journalist, a writer. He's the author of the book My Promised Land. And Ezra Klein asked Ari specifically about the different views of the war between Israel and what it looks like for the rest of the world. Here's what Mr. Shavit had to say.
Israelis are seeing a different war than the one that Americans see. You see one war film, horror film, and we see at home another war film, horror film. Israelis are stuck in October 7th while the world has forgot October 7th, nearly forgot October 7th.
That's so interesting that those inside are still in October 7th. That's an interesting perspective and one we often don't think about. You think about the kind of destruction, the lives that were lost, the brutality of it all. In fact, we're going to go back to a conversation I had with Rabbi Brad Hirschfield in the next segment because he was down there near the border with Gaza, looking at some of those places that were burned out, some of those places where just savage things happened. And so for much of Israel, they're still there. They're still on October 7th. Ari Shavit also shared what he sees in terms of the perception from inside of Israel as far as what's happening on American college campuses.
I'm deeply saddened. I'll tell you what I don't see. I don't see Gandhi-like marches. I don't see Martin Luther King kind of demonstrations. I don't see an understanding of the profound tragedy that we are trapped in. And when you see that it goes from legitimate criticism of Israel to a kind of obsession with hating it, then I wonder, it makes me, beyond the sadness, it scares me.
Not seeing any Gandhis or Martin Luther King Jr.'s leading any of those protests. When the obsession becomes what you're against or what you hate, criticism is one thing. And yes, we've got to have that space for sure. But when that becomes the obsession, you never get to that Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi moment. I think that's a really important point that Ari Shavit brought up again on this New York Times podcast. Also talked about the difference between criticizing Israel, the government, and what's happening there versus the poisonous path that leads ultimately to the other big problem, which is anti-Semitism.
You have justified criticism of Israel because there is wrongdoing. You have understandable criticism of Israel because some things that are actually justified, but it's difficult to understand when you don't get the complexity. There is the vicious criticism of Israel and there's anti-Semitism. I say, no, when you come to judge Israel, you should criticize many things, but take a universal standard. You want to criticize the way we wage war, compare it to the way America waged war in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other place.
So you got to get to the complexities, you got to get to the nuances if you're going to really get into the criticism space. Again, deconstruction is not demanding. Opposition is it requires no real effort. It's easy. It's oftentimes a little bit lazy. And so you have to be willing to wade into the deeper conversations if you're going to get to the truth, which is what we should all be focused on. Now, Mr. Shavit also talked about the Israeli goals of the war in fighting the Hamas terrorist organization as the focus, not the Palestinian people.
And sadly, the way the war was waged on our side, and I think we had to do it, and we had to defend ourselves, and we had the right to defend ourselves, but we should have been much more sophisticated. It should have been clear to any person watching television or TikTok or whatever in the United States that we are fighting Hamas, we are not fighting the Palestinians. I think that eventually Hamas has to be crushed. Hamas is threatening the lives of Israelis and the liberty of Palestinians. And we all have to unite in eradicating Hamas and liberate the Palestinians. I want every Palestinian to feel that he has more freedom, more prosperity, more hope every year while Israel's security is not in danger.
Okay, now that's one worth thinking again about, to just step back and say, one, he was very critical of his own government in terms of the way this war against Hamas has been waged, that it should have been different. There should have been more precision, maybe a little more planning, maybe a little more restraint. But that the idea is ultimately to fight for the lives of the Israelis and for the liberty of the Palestinians. And in order to do that, you have to remove Hamas. And I think ultimately a lot of folks are saying, you know, there is a path to a two-state solution, where you can have the liberty of the Palestinian people and self-governance and self-rule, and you can have the safety and security that the Israeli people want to have to live their everyday lives. Those are compatible principles. And too often when we conflate it, too often when we rush to the headlines and skip across the surface, it's all or nothing. And we don't get to the more nuanced piece of the puzzle. And I think that's an important line that Mr. Shavit gave us there in terms of let's be about the lives and let's be about the liberty. And that applies to the Palestinian people and it applies to the Israeli people. And those are compatible. And that's actually where peace can actually be constructed. Finally, he said that it's up to all of us to find a different path that could produce hope rather than fall into just the tribalistic traps that lead to nowhere.
So it's a moral responsibility upon all of us to get to work and to create a different path and find a different path so we can prevent catastrophe and actually bring back some hope.
And it is about bringing back hope. So that's a really interesting perspective. Again, going back to this New York Times podcast, and Ezra Klein, of course, is the host of that podcast, and that was Ari Shavit, Israeli writer and journalist. And I think the perspective is important for us here in the U.S. because sometimes we're just pushing our messages out, but we don't really think, how's that being perceived everywhere else? And so it's nice every once in a while to get a look from the other side. And we worry about what's going on college campuses. We worry about the debate over aid to Israel inside of Congress. And we should look at what does the rest of the world see? And how are they perceiving our conversations, our protests, our approach, our policy? That's always worth a good reflection. We're going to step aside for some bottom of the hour news. And when we come back, we're going to continue inside of Israel. We're going to go back to my conversation from yesterday with Rabbi Brad Hirschfield from inside Jerusalem. And he went right down to the Gaza border. And we'll get some perspective of what that looks like from that perspective, rather than just sitting comfortably here in the United States. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It is great to be with you today, as it always is. I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, I have a good news, bad news scenario for you. The bad news is we still have 6 more months until the 2024 election cycle is completed. The good news is today is exactly 6 months, not to the first Tuesday of November, but to the first Wednesday of November, which I think is the most important day in an election year. Yes, the first Tuesday of November is important. Casting your vote, making your voice heard, it is our duty, it is our right and privilege as citizens of this country. But the most important thing is what happens the day after, because Wednesday morning always comes. And so as we look towards that, we are exactly 6 months from the first Wednesday of November. That's the good news. Because while it will provide us that exhale after what I'm sure is going to be a little exhausting, maybe even a bit exasperating as we work our way through, the good news is the first Wednesday of November always comes. And as critical as the first Tuesday of November is, our country, this is what you need to remember today, our country is always driven forward by first Wednesdays. So the drive to the first Tuesday, yes, it'll be focused on power and control and winners and losers, but it often distracts us from what I think are the more important conversations and the real pressing problems we need to deal with in this country. Sadly, both sides of the political aisle have breathlessly declared, and they will do it over and over and over the next 6 months, that if their opponents or enemies, those evil, awful, horribles of the other party win, and they assume control, that Armageddon's going to ensue, grandma's going to get pushed off the cliff, our children are going to be doomed to destruction. Well, here's the deal. It's never happened. It's never been proven to be the case in America because of Wednesday. The first Wednesday of November really matters. For the past several election cycles, I have attempted to draw attention to the first Wednesday of November. And since we're exactly 6 months out from that, I think it's important for us to remember that the answers to what ails the nation are not going to be found in the marbled halls of Washington, D.C. They're going to be found in your home and my home, your neighborhood, my neighborhood. And that Wednesday morning is where citizens in towns and cities across the country will get up. First Wednesday of November, you're going to get up, you're going to go to work, you're going to provide for your loved ones, you're going to start a business, you're going to get kids to school, you're going to help a neighbor in need, you're going to volunteer in the community, you're going to reach out to a friend that's struggling, you're going to engage in the free market economy and institutions of civil society, all of those things that have driven the United States of America from the very beginning. Over two centuries, we've got a pretty good track record, folks. And it is as though the politically obsessed have lost their knowledge and perspective of history. The country has survived fierce division, hotly contested elections in the past. And despite the noisy and all the negative chatter and clamor of flailing political consultants and media experts, Wednesday morning always comes and the country moves on. In fact, I'm convinced more than ever that American history is filled with Wednesday mornings. Following great wars, big-time social strife, scandals at the highest levels of government, 9/11, riots, mass shootings, contested elections, Wednesday morning always comes in this country. And it comes, and it will come exactly 6 months from today. It'll come because the American people will make it come. That's what we do here. And so despite the constant drumbeat, the bemoaning of a deeply divided and angry America, I'm convinced that the American people are starving for something different. And we'll find that way. Because I don't believe we're that divided. I do believe we are separated. But most of that is self-separation and self-isolation. And so we can look back to just prove it out. Thomas Jefferson was a compelling and complex, inspired and flawed human being. All of us are, of course. He was a slave owner, and he also provided words and leadership that compelled Americans toward building bridges of unity, harmony, opportunity. I have always found that Jefferson's first inaugural address was quite instructive in the division, the turmoil that we're hearing about, that has everybody wringing their hands about what will happen on the first Tuesday of November. So Jefferson won an election that was so nasty and so contentious that many people feared that the election was going to lead to, this is from the news, riots, rebellion, and even a new revolution. Sound familiar? Well, that was Thomas Jefferson's victory and his election to be president of the United States. But ever instructive, and I think in an act of humility, a signal to the nation, Jefferson entered the Senate chamber of the Capitol dressed as an ordinary citizen. Both Washington and Adams, of course, had worn their ceremonial swords when they took the oath of office. Jefferson left the sword at home. And here's what Jefferson said. He said, "All too will bear in mind this sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, that the minority possesses their equal rights, which equal law must protect. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind." Now, unity is not conformity. You hear me say it often. Oneness is not sameness in this country. And Jefferson recognized that America has a different way of doing this. He knew that oneness was found in a Wednesday morning approach to all the things that unite the nation. And Jefferson eloquently declared in that first inaugural that every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. And so I think as we look 6 months out, yes, the first Tuesday of November will come. Votes will be cast. Winners and losers will be declared. Many will say it's the beginning of the end. And we all should follow Jefferson's model and just leave our virtual swords at home. We can lay down our social media rants, our verbal assaults. And we can stop demonizing those that we disagree with or question the patriotism of those who have an approach to policy or progress that's different, even contrary to our own. And so we can do this, folks. We'll get to the first Tuesday of November. And then I promise you, I guarantee you, Wednesday morning will come. The first Wednesday will come in this country, and we'll all get up, we'll go to work, we'll help each other, and we will be the ones that promote and create a more perfect union. That wraps it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I am Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.